Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Joss Hantram, a partner at Terrafinity, where sustainability isn't just a concept, but a practical pathway to a better future. Joss doesn't promise quick fixes. Instead, he offers innovative, impactful sustainability strategies for businesses and nonprofits. With a rich history of collaboration with prestigious organizations like Elopak, InterSnack, WWF International, and some contract work for the World Economic Forum, Joss has been instrumental in pioneering sustainability initiatives. He's the lead author of WBCSD's Future Proof Business Guide and a key figure in projects like Building Bridges, aligning sustainability with capital market engagement. An author of five insightful books on sustainability, Joss's expertise is sought after globally. When not shaping sustainable futures, he immerses himself in music and nature's wonders. I've asked Joss, a visionary in sustainability, to join us here today to share his story and guide us through the complexities of sustainable value creation, blending purpose, process, and profit. Joss, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Daryl. Thank you. It's my pleasure to join you, and thank you for such a fulsome introduction. Much appreciated.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. And I'm curious, we talked before we did the interview, obviously, we had some, you said some good things. I piqued my interest about that. Before we even get into sustainability and profit, how did you even get down this path? Like the mix between sustainability and business? Is this something like your parents were involved in? Is this like a family torch that you're carrying forward? Were they entrepreneurs in some capacity? Were they strong environmentalists? Where does this come from?
So the sort of answer to all of that is yes. So my parents were both very keen amateur naturalists. My mother was a... basically able to learn new biological phylum at the drop of a hat and became an expert mycologist. They were both very interested in nature. We were lucky enough to grow up on the edges of some fantastic countryside and essentially ran around the woods and the downs, hitting each other with sticks. This is myself and my brother, who I now work with, and climbing trees and doing sort of nature-related stuff. Right. My dad was an entrepreneur. They were both research chemists. My father was a mad inventor and worked in energy research, did a little bit of work that related to the fuel cells that were used in the Apollo spacecraft in doing gas research and various different research jobs. But he then invented a new type of gas sensor and set up a company, which I think at the time was the first a commercial spin-off from a UK university, and founded a company that basically had utilized a diffusion method to assess gas concentrations in a cheaper and smaller and more effective way than had been done before. Essentially, it was what's called an electronic canary. Instead of having canaries down coal mines, you used one of his instruments with his gas sensor in it, which did a lot for gas safety in mines.
And for canary.
like an electronic canary, yeah. And essentially, the company was a spin-off, and it's now part of Honeywell. So I suppose there is a mix of environmental interest, but also entrepreneurialism that I've tried to pursue with varying degrees of success.
Yeah, and I love that because the two can come together. They're not juxtaposed. They can be good bedfellows. So how did you even get into business then? What was one of your earliest endeavors?
So essentially, it was a necessity. So when I studied what's called human ecology, which is like a multidisciplinary degree, which was trying to explore the nature of humanity and how humans fit into complex systems. And it was trying to develop people that were capable of appreciating complexity and synthesis, if you like. So we studied things like anthropology, soil science, philosophy, economics, development studies, all of these different things to try and get over the challenge that you have of sort of canalized, very specific lines of knowledge and to see how they all fit together. At the time that I was doing this, which was the late 80s, most of the jobs that were there for the likes of graduates like me were in the public sector. There was an economic downturn, and when I graduated, there weren't any jobs. I set up in business with my brother, who I still work with now, and I've worked with on and off over the last 30 years. So it is a family business, as you alluded to earlier. And so I suppose there was a necessity to make your own living rather than necessarily depend on other people. Over the course of my career, I have worked with and for other people. I've had several what you might call proper jobs in the interim, 5 years with the Worldwide Fund for Nature in the UK, several years with a small consulting firm in London, and more recently about 3 years as a director with the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, and that was a part-time role. But most of that the time I've worked as a consultant, and a majority of that time for myself and my own business.
And it sounds like you launched in a recession. What's that? What, can you speak to that? There's probably some people that are going down that path right now.
Each recession is a little bit different, so I don't know how universal the experience is. At the time that we did this, and this is early 90s, there weren't jobs, but there was some money, if you like. So the money that organisations would have put into roles that was potentially free for to be able to do work that would support the purpose of the role, even though they wouldn't have a role itself. In the course of my career, there have been many economic up and downturns, and sustainability has generally in the past been the sort of first thing to go when there's an economic downturn. I think more recently, and since the 2008 crash, that's been slightly less of the case, and I think that's indicative that in principle people have got the need for sustainability. We don't know what the current situation is, and it's a little uncertain in the UK. And so I think that, like with all of these things, it's about finding where are the opportunities, where's the bit that you can think that you can play, how do you understand how what you can do can bring value to the clients that you work with, how can they understand, and this has been very much our thing, how can they understand sustainability as an innovation drive and not necessarily as a thing to comply to?
I want to talk about that for a second. I'm a writer downer. So I was writing. I want to talk about that because I think I mentioned before, we did a bunch of research on what drives success for small and medium sized businesses. Spent about 50 grand. I hired 10 assistants to help me go through it. And there was a couple of things that I think relate to what you're saying. So one, when it comes to money management, one of the key success drivers of managing the money is investing in two things. One, high quality products and services. Well, three things. High quality products and services, R&D spending, and asset and sales growth. Those three things are positively correlated. The other things that are money management was low capital investment, leanness, debt-free. And then, of course, capacity utilization, which is a fancy word meaning get everything you can from what you got, from your employees, from the inventory you've got, from the money that you have. So those were all under money management. But one of the things that I wasn't so much, when I saw it, it made sense. But sometimes the way we get treated by big businesses, it shocked me. I was like, really? When it came to marketing strategy, one of our 8 critical success factors, one of the critical success factors in a marketing strategy is corporate social responsibility, which we broke down as community development, ethical values, and conformity to legal processes. And that's because people want to know when they buy something that it's not because some kid is being whipped in another country and he's got bleeding and the mom has 3 kids that died because she couldn't breastfeed them because she's got to work and the boss won't let, like, these terrible. No, people don't want to contribute to pain and suffering in the world. And they don't want their luxury to be, frankly, just pissing in someone else's drinking water, so to speak. So there is a certain extent of this where, and there's profit in it as well. I think there can be immense profit in it. And originally, before we realized that we were pissing and defecating in our drinking water, people loved the indoor toilet system. It reduced, and sanitation went way up. People were like, this is great. I push a button and it's gone. There was no political protest. There was no one carrying signs. Flies are our friends. Flies are our friends. This wasn't a thing, indoor plumbing. So I feel like what we're facing now is the other side of the coin, where we figured out a way to hit the flush and it disappears from our house, but it doesn't actually solve the waste issue.
Absolutely. So there's a few things to unpack in what you're talking about. So in terms of the first element, which is how does sustainability fit with value and value creation? And this is something that we've been working on for I think about 20 years. I first did some work in it while I was at WWF UK, and we did a couple of documents looking at how do we understand sustainability in terms of business value. And fundamentally, we tend to be focusing significantly upon opportunity for value creation. So if you think broadly about compliance, that tends to be about value conservation. So how do I make sure that I'm not running a risk of a fine or running risk of reputational challenges, et cetera? In terms of the sort of categories of financial value that sustainability, or sorry, that are commonly utilized by investors and companies and sustainability speaks to, there is revenue, there's costs, there's intangible value, and there's risk. And the costs and risk tend to be what they call downside elements. And that speaks to what you were saying. How do we not get a reputation for doing nasty things in our supply chain that people wouldn't like? How do we make sure that we're getting our bang for buck in terms of our spending? And how do we make sure that we understand what risks are posed by what types of issue, challenges, behaviors, etc.? The revenue side and the intangible value side are big elements that sustainability can contribute to, as well as costs. Obviously, if you are utilizing or extracting the best resource efficiency out of the resources that you buy, then there's a really clear direct bottom line benefit. The risk side is not just obviously downside risk, but there's upside risk as well. How do we understand and anticipate the big picture challenges that might give rise to opportunity for our business model or threaten our ability to operate as we think is normal? And therefore, how do we potentially think differently about what we do and how we do it? In terms of the, and we can come back to that if you want, but the latter point that you were making about the sort of indoor toilets are great, but we're finding the challenges with them. That speaks to the idea about the idea that how do we treat the environment? Do we treat the environment as a free good because it's effectively limitless? And this is in the fundamental principles of most economics, which essentially says there are a whole bunch of things that we don't really have to price or worry about because there's so much of it that we can keep accessing it. And this is a point that we discussed when we first spoke, which is the sort of we are, as a species, getting large enough to see the limits of the place that we're operating in, the planet. We're large enough to see the net impacts, or sorry, the mass effect of 7+ billion people operating in the way that we do, utilizing the resources that you do, and disposing of them in the way that we do. And we're starting to see that at a planetary level in terms of things like plastic pollution, in terms of things like carbon and climate impacts, in terms of nature loss, all of these sorts of things. Yeah, there is this idea about how can we comfortably consider that we can just throw stuff away, or that there isn't a way in the first place, because our away is someone else's place to live.
Mostly because the things that we're making don't decompose readily. Nuclear waste, plastics, a lot of the stuff. If we were making everything out of bamboo, hemp, and whatever else, it wouldn't be as much of an issue because it would quickly biodegrade. So I think a big issue is the biodegradableness of it. The other issue is some of the stuff is also, even beyond taking care of the planet, some of the stuff is getting into our food chain, like microplastics and heavy metals in fish and things like that. So I think that's a key element. I know there's a lot of, so a couple of things I guess I want to mention. We'll sandwich this positive, negative, positive. To speak to that, I think there's, like we talked about profit in that, I forget the guys, I wish I remembered his name. He deserves all the credit. There's a man who, I think he's German. He created a car wash that was completely zero emission. And he got some money from the United Nations and he started, I think it was called ZERI, Zero Emissions Research Institute. And I remember it because I was so in.
Günter Pauli, I think he is.
Is that, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That sounds right, but I'd have to look it up to check. But then he made a brewery, and the brewery had zero emissions, where he had a water wheel on a river, which generated the power for the brewery. The hops, they would spread out and grow mushrooms. No, they would use the hops to feed the chickens, and the chicken poop they would use to grow mushrooms. And he had this whole ecosystem built where everything had its purpose and was in its right place. And there's some other real world examples of this sort of thing. Fluoride, a lot of people talk about how it's poisonous, but it does help strengthen our teeth in small amounts. They add it to our water. This used to be a waste product. I think it was steel or aluminum manufacturing. So they found a purpose for it. Whey protein, major health product right now, was actually a waste product from milk processing. So I think it comes back to what you're saying, is that operating the way that we do is the problem. It's not that we can't solve it. It's that there's things that we need to close the gaps, and we need to do some things like not maybe defecate in our drinking water. Like, that would be bad. We've spent so much on cow manure. Why don't, like, there's just like, just smarten up, people. I followed a guy, Michael Reynolds, since I was 19. He's the founder of Earthships. And one of the most thing about Earthships, they use six systems that make sustainable houses. And one is on-site wastewater treatment. They separate gray water, black water. The gray water essentially goes to a greenhouse, or he calls them botanical cells. And the black water goes to your leach field or septic tank. And so he's growing food for the herbs and vegetables from the water you took a shower in, or the whatever you did your dishes with. And so there's just, it's just, so I want to talk about that, because talking about the value creation from tucking in these corners, we talked about Buckminster Fuller before, and how he was a design revolutionary out of the 1950s. And he said, there's no such thing as pollution. It's just an accumulation of chemicals in the wrong place, just like two magnets,
yes,
north ends facing each other.
Yeah. So and this is, as you say, Buckminster Fuller was a pioneer, conceptual pioneer in thinking globally, and thinking about our industrial production models, mm-hmm, and how fit for purpose they were for the long term. The other sort of concepts that speak to that are things like industrial ecology, which is exactly as you talked about, which is how do we understand industrial production, or even not necessarily heavy industry, but the utilization of stuff for making things. And how do we understand that in as an ecological system rather than as a series of discrete entities that have no interest in each other? The other sort of big concept in this is cradle to cradle. And this is from a book called McDonough and Braungart. And they talk about two spheres, the ecosphere and the technosphere. And the ecosphere is where essentially you've got biologically derived materials that are safe to use and potentially safe to dispose in natural systems. And you've got the technosphere, which is materials that are scarce, potentially dangerous, could be polluting. And what they talk about there, and this is also part of what's called circular economy thinking, is that what the design principle is that you try and keep access to, perpetual access to those materials. And materials like plastic, as you said, you can recycle, you can keep in a technical cycle and maintain your utility and access to them, rather than treating them as a one-shot deal where you get your raw materials from mostly from fossil fuels. You make it, you stick it in something, and you don't really give two hoots about what happens to it afterwards.
Right.
So conceptually, there are a number of ways that people have thought about how do we think about industrial production and serving product or providing products and services at scale to a global population in ways that have a radically different relationship to impact. At present, we have very much a cradle to grave type of approach, which is essentially we make stuff. It's a one-shot deal. Things like this, which have got incredibly valuable materials in them, tend to, when they've stopped being used, sit in someone's desk drawer because they think, I don't really know what to do about that. So there are conceptual and a lot of actual real world innovations that are thinking about how do we redesign the processes by which we produce and consume stuff.
Yeah, because if you do it right, someone else's waste product can be your free resource. I talked about Earthships. Michael Reynolds built for himself a very tidy little business empire, building houses out of used tires, packing them full of dirt. If you pack a used tire full of dirt, you've got a rubber and steel encased thermal mass brick. Essentially, it's earthquake proof. It's fireproof. It's good for typhoons. And this is a waste product, otherwise known as a waste product. Now there's off-gassing and the idea. But the point is that by being innovative, and things are constantly changing, so there is value in that. I want to ask, because you've been in the field for so long, I said positive, negative, positive. Can we talk a little bit about hidden agendas? Because I do feel that there's valid concerns about psychopaths weaponizing people's altruistic values, or just greedy people that are, it's like the politician that puts the kickback into the budget, you know what I mean? For that they're approving for whatever. There's all sorts of ways that people with good intentions or bad intentions can manipulate this stuff. And I'm not asking you to necessarily name names or anything, but you are the sustainability expert here. Can you speak a little bit to that? So maybe the dark side of sustainability a little bit, and just in a means to educate people so we can walk into this, because we gotta do something with this planet Earth. I'll say one thing quickly. There's an idea of spaceship Earth where we live on this, in this biosphere that provides everything we need. And that's relatively false in the sense that without technology, the planet is actually very inhospitable. I'm from Canada, you're in the UK. We would die very quickly without modern technology. So we need technology to actually inhabit more than just this tiny band around the equator. And so there is a bit of a love-hate relationship, you should say, push-pull with Mother Nature. But we do need to do something. There's a lot of things that are hard to ignore, oceans full of plastic, et cetera. Can you just speak to maybe some of the dark sides or things that we have to be aware of as we walk towards a more sustainable future to avoid bad apples spoiling the bunch?
Daryl, I think, so the dark side, I'm not sure there's a darker side to sustainability than there is to any other area of human life. And I think that we're all capable of doing things that can give rise to unintended consequence. I think that, as you say, we live in an incredibly complex world where we're all to varying degrees complicit in good and bad outcomes further down the line. From our perspective, and this is something that we touched upon when you and I spoke previously, we're not particularly interested in a political agenda for sustainability. We believe that the sort of truisms of sustainability are essentially, we all do live on a finite planet, which is open to energy. It's pretty much closed to matter unless we have meteorite strikes, which have their own attendant problems. And we have a population of 7+ billion people who essentially all at the highest level tend to want fairly similar things: security for themselves and their family, quality of life, opportunity to earn, opportunity to have some sort of positive future, health, nutrition, those sorts of things. And the challenge that we face, whatever political color that you have, is how do we manage to try, or how do we try and aspire, if we're interested in that, to deliver those things, the quality of life, the security, the ability potentially to use your vote, education, the ability to develop careers, etc. How do we do that in cognizance of the fact that we're a species at scale, that on a planet with a relatively or with relatively noticeable limits, and whose systems are being put under pressure by the way that we're using and distributing resources at the moment? We know that essentially people tend to use the environment as a bit of a political football. We've never been particularly interested in that, because we're interested in the physics and the science of what being a species that utilizes stuff for good purpose, as you say. Right. Technology brings us security and warmth and flush toilets and all of these things. And personal mobility and reasonable freedom of choice, a freedom of choice that hasn't been available throughout most of human history for more people. So there are huge numbers of benefits to how, for certain people in the world, if we're lucky enough to be born in the right place, there's a huge quality of life benefits that have come from our humanity's use of and deployment of technology. So I'm not trying to dodge the question, but essentially, it seems to be a human capacity for certain people to want to aggregate and utilize power. But it's not something that we've particularly seen. Most sustainability people are pretty powerless and pretty poor, to be honest. We don't, there's no sort of, or well, I've never come across any sort of dark, rich masters of sustainability, I have to say.
Well, Gisele Maxwell, Gisane, they added passports from United Nations for Terra Mar, which was, I think the big thrust of it was sustainability of some sort. I could Google it, look it up, but Terra Mar was, they had their own passports, like their own country, her and Jeffrey. They had a submarine provided to them, and they were stewards of the ocean, so to speak. So there are, I agree with everything that you say, and I agree with everything that you say. And I think that you're right. Just as there's good and evil in all people, there's this, I really like how you mentioned the political football. I think that is something that people, you know, and hopefully people have learned a lot through COVID versus just blindly trusting the media source. We thought we were so civilized and advanced, and yet I know a ton of people, myself included, that feel incredibly betrayed by certain institutions and agencies. And somehow we do have to work closer together towards walking forward. I was interested by hearing you say have and use your vote, because that's a very interesting concept, because I know that some people are very much in favor of more government oversight. But that's part of why we have the vote. And it's the same thing with free speech. If people are not allowed to articulate their thoughts and ideas, like emotion, energy in motion, without an exhaust valve, people will erupt in violence. And so free speech is incredibly important. And I think it's similar that if people don't have a say, whether it's voting or what, and I do agree that sometimes the public is ignorant on issues, and they're just, as a mob, like mob mentality, maybe not the most intelligent entity at certain times and certain things. So that's, and this is what I wanted to bring up, not to point fingers or lay blame, but to just put some things on the table to say these are things that people really need to discuss. Like you talked about political footballs, people getting agendas. I saw recently, to give credit where credit is due, I'm a fan of Mr. Beast. Not, I don't spend much time on YouTube, to be honest, but I'm a fan of him and what he does and what he's about. And he just recently dug 100 wells in Africa, giving them to communities. And there's a bit of a cancel culture attempt to cancel him, so to speak. And then when people dug into it, they found out that the main proponents of it was a Kenyan politician and this lady who had raised $120,000 for her NGO that she spent $81,000 of on herself. In Canada, where I'm from, it's recently come to light that our government spent $647,000 on consultants to help them figure out how to reduce consulting fees. Some of this stuff is just, so I'm just glad, and I'm not saying we're going to solve them now or here, but these are the things that I'm glad you brought up. There's the concept of the political football. There's the delicate act between letting people have a vote and having to make a decision like a stern but loving parent as a government. The unintended consequences of things, and which talk about people that have and want to aggregate power. Right now, the WHO is pushing for superseding sovereign rights on how to deal with pandemics, or more alarmingly, pathogens of pandemic potential, which would give them power to overrule any country and how to respond to a potential pandemic. And so it's an interesting time where we're moving forward towards this world. And the last thing I want to say on it is the Dutch used to be the world superpower. And I believe it was 1816, the UK took it from them. And then in 1916, the United States became the world superpower and took it from the Brits. And now we're in 2023. And I don't think America's going away, but we are definitely apparently looking at more of a multipolar world. And there's some other things, like people talk about social credit scores and this thing. And these things are very frightening, because when people talk about carbon emissions, everything a human does creates carbon, from farting to flipping light switches. And if all of a sudden everything I do is being tracked and monitored for a carbon social credit score, but the rich can buy credits and greenwash stuff, these are things that we have to put on the table, because just like a solid business plan, you don't want everyone to tell you everything is sunshine and rainbows. You want to give someone a solid business plan and them to tell you what's wrong with it, so you can fix that and have a greater chance of success. So I guess this is off the cuff, but a checklist or a process that you would recommend people consider whenever they're either presented with a sustainability initiative or considering one themselves. You talked about one, unintended consequences. Is there like a mnemonic or a heuristic people can consider? Or do we just point out the things to be like, hey, there's a rock here, there's a rock there, careful?
In simple terms, yeah, be careful is quite a useful. Pay attention and be careful. I think in sustainability terms, a lot of what we're talking about, if you think about how companies understand and navigate operating contexts, they're pretty familiar with doing that. And you have all sorts of models that are out there to help companies to understand what their business model is, what it depends upon in terms of resources, people, economic conditions, taxation rates, all of these sorts of factors, what they call drivers or influences of corporate success. And the fundamental thing that we've been saying for a long time is sustainability is an additional set of drivers that you should be paying attention to in your context analysis, in your strategic analysis processes, that can potentially give rise to opportunities, threats and challenges. They can give rise to differential costs. They can give rise to scarcity issues, etc. So to some extent, contextual awareness, paying attention to what is it that we depend upon in order to provide our product and service, is our dependency upon, requires someone else's diminished quality of life at the expense of our own? That's one question. Does it rely upon a resource that is scarce, problematic, dangerous, come from somewhere that we can't rely on? All of these sorts of things. Does our business model utilize that resource or those people in ways that is sustainable, is likely to allow us to carry on because we're not giving rise to consequences that are likely to threaten our ability to operate over the long term? So those sorts of things are things that we try and help people to explore. We see sustainability as just good long-term business strategy and planning, because the longer into the future that you look and the larger you are as an entity, or the more significant you would like to be, the more you need to think about the resilience and longevity of your business model. If you're motivated only in the next 2 weeks, morning, 3 weeks, three months,
next quarter,
then it's less likely that you'll be thinking more fundamentally about what is it we depend upon and how are we likely to be able to maintain that. One of the ways that we tend to try and frame this is that sustainability is either about doing the same things very differently or about doing very different things. So they're both innovation orientated. The same things very differently. Are there different ways of providing the products or service that we supply, but in really radically different ways, or with a radically different resource utilization, or with a different relationship between ourselves and our customers? The other side is doing very different things. And this is where concepts like product to service come in. Is it in our interest to make and sell phones, or is it in our interest to sell mobile telephony capacity so that actually we retain ownership of the phone? The customer accesses service. And if you utilize that perspective, and which has pros and cons, and sometimes people disagree with it, but it's in your interest to make a phone capable of being dismantled because you're interested in retaining the utility of the resources that's gone into them.
Right.
So you make them easy to dismantle, you make them easy to be reused in different ways with the minimum of energy inputs. And there are arguments. People like to own stuff, but people also like to get the utility out of things. And it's figuring out what are the things that we want to sell as a product that someone owns? What are the things that actually are much better provided as services so that people can utilize them? And it's not actually on them to keep up to date with the latest technology. It's our problem as a producer to make sure that they can continue having access to that. And that means that we're actually utilizing resources in a radically different way. So it's more like the cradle to cradle model. There are lots of different ways of thinking about these things, and they have pros and cons. But understanding sustainability as an innovation driver, how does the fact that we have a limited planet scarce resources and increasing demands upon those. What does that force? What do they say? Necessity is the mother of invention.
Right.
And that's an element, I think, which is woven through all of these things. And the challenge is really, how do we understand and anticipate and evolve corporate forms, corporate behaviors in such a way that we're most likely to all succeed over the long term, rather than run into disruption shocks and have to figure out how we deal with those things after the fact.
Yeah, that's interesting. I agree with that a lot. It comes back to this: do we solve it as a unit or as individuals? Because government is notorious for being highly inefficient and very wasteful. But at the same time, how do you herd all the cats if everyone's just focused on paying rent this month, or like I said, this meeting payroll the next few weeks? But the problem of consolidating power is that we've seen over and over again, communism equals death of millions. No, free markets have enabled more people to have a higher standard of living than anything else that we've discovered per se. And markets are unknown and unknowable. In the sense that if I asked you today how many people are in market to buy a car, you might be able to tell me some indicators, but ultimately the true number is unknown and unknowable, is constantly changing. But everyone can acknowledge and recognize excellence. And by having a free market where people compete, the most excellent should rise to the top. It may take time for them to get recognized, but ultimately the most excellent will hopefully be adopted. Whereas if we have a static kind of society where behaviors are prohibited, people live in small cities and they're not permitted to do whatever. I know that short distance flights were shut down in Europe, I heard at one point in time, which forced people to drive, which burn more fuel. It's interesting because we have to walk this path, but we have to do it together. It's an interesting challenge for humanity. We have to face our shadow, so to speak, and walk into a more virtuous future. And the rewards are great for people that can figure this out. Again, like we talked about, I gave multiple examples. I think in this call we've given, again, we're not going to solve anything perhaps on this 60-minute session, but hopefully for the people listening, I mean, I interviewed this 15-year-old for the show today because I saw him posting and he's working for an 8-figure company as a high-ticket sales closer. And I was just impressed because he's like 15. I was more concerned with what was growing in my pants when I was 15 than trying to work with a big company and teach people. Anyway, he was a very impressive individual for a 15-year-old. And so I'm very hopeful for the kids in the future. We just have to figure out how to do this because some rules are written in blood. And to relearn those lessons because we have generational amnesia would be tragic. And so it's just an interesting, what I have from this, first off, we talk about the importance of multidisciplinary thinking. That's your degree, your background was in that. Michelangelo, Da Vinci, plenty of people were able to become experts in multiple fields of thought. I feel like some of the things that have been of advantage to me personally is I haven't had a television since I was 17. I would get into series stuff, and then I learned I just don't watch series anymore. I watch movies because they have the definite ending. And oftentimes I don't even finish movies when I start them these days. And I think that capturing our time to realize that not everything in the jungle kills you and eats you. Some things just latch onto you and feed on you as long as possible. They're called parasites and they exist in society. In fact, there's a chart. If you look at life expectancy versus healthcare expenditure, our world and data has this chart where you can clearly see that United States is basically double the world average and has lower middle of the pack performance. And clearly their healthcare system is not optimized to be the best in the world. It's optimized to be the most profitable in the world from that chart alone. So I'm on a soapbox, I need to get off, but being aware of parasites, maybe focusing on long-term thinking, recognizing that sustainability can be a source of profit. I mentioned Ziri, I mentioned fluoride, whey protein. I liked how you talked about the two different spheres, that one is like a biological ecosystem that we recycle and the other one is a technological sort of ecosystem where we have to, maybe like you mentioned with the mobile phones, we have to design and maybe with regulations, we have to regulate industries so things are more renewable. The right to repair was a big win, yeah. I think, in that respect, right? And then we also have to make sure, understand that this is an inevitable thing on a long enough timeline. Even if we just decide to shoot all of our junk into the sun, we're going to run out of junk to make. We're going to run out of resources to make that junk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The stuff that makes that junk is, we will be potentially cursed by future generations who are going, we could have made some really creative use out of that. Yeah. So I think you've touched on a whole range of things, Daryl. We essentially believe that you speak about democracy and regulation and all these things. There's a huge amount to be said, as exactly as you mentioned, for the ability of humanity to be creative, innovative, to be entrepreneurial, to have a space to play, to find out, to deploy, etc. And regimes or regulatory requirements that are too specific, and you can have regulation that specifies the wrong types of technology, which has its own unintended consequences. So the space for entrepreneurialism and creativity that we associate with free markets is one that we'd be foolish to let go of. The challenge with environmental issues is, are there motivations within the capitalist system, within democratic systems, etc., to anticipate and prompt the types of developments that are required? Mm-hmm. And is there a role for a baseline regulation, which essentially says there are things you really shouldn't do, anything, or here are the characteristics that you need to think about or apply to your design or apply to your product, or here are the costs that... And some of these costs will be derived from market mechanisms, because markets will recognize that materials are scarce and start to price them accordingly. Some regulation will seek to be anticipatory and say, we can see at the mass level a problem with the production or utilization of X. So therefore, we believe that we should put in either incentives or disincentives to prompt people to be innovative in response to how they deal with that, how they avoid the utilization of that, or how they maximize the utility of something. And the best regulation is one which puts in a floor, and then it puts in incentives for innovation, not one which says there is only one way of doing it and you must do it this way. So there is essentially, as I spoke earlier, classical economics has treated the environment, and to some extent society, as a free good. It expects there's always going to be some available, and we don't really have to worry about our utilization of it. Recognizing that we have a finite planet with a large demand upon its resources means that we need to think a bit differently about how we price, how we value, how we prioritize, and how we do things. And that's either going to come from entrepreneurial spirit, it's going to come from baseline regulation, which says, look, this is pretty dangerous, don't do it. Or it's going to come from a response to shocks. Or if we do it right, it'll come from a positive combination of, there are certain things we shouldn't do, be entrepreneurial on top to figure out how you would utilize things better, prioritize things better, build businesses which are capable of resilience over the long term.
Right. I mean,
here's an interesting concept. In the UK, we have been toying with the idea of resilience reporting for companies. So they're not just, here's our annual report, but here is a five-year resilience report, which seeks to explore how do we believe our business model, our resource dependencies, etc., will enable us to be resilient over the slightly longer term. So you've started to get, with that concept, the idea of businesses not just thinking about the latest quarterly return, but what is the fundamentals of our business model? What does that, as I said, I've gone said this a couple of times, what are our dependencies? What are we vulnerable to? What's changing? And how do we think about and plan for the consistent evolution of our company such that we're capable of performing over the longer term? And that's an example of a sort of regulation which is positively orientated. It's not telling companies what to do. It's saying, be clear about how resilient your business model is. And that's a really useful thing.
Charles, this has been a great call. I've got a couple of pages of notes. I do want to be respectful of your time. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you about?
Who knows? I think what we would say is that I think fundamentally, understanding the sort of fundamental nature of existence as we see it, and obviously people see reality in different ways, but why we think sustainability is important is because there's no money without people and society. There's no society without a functioning and healthy natural environment. And as such, paying attention to the quality, the quantity of life, its sophistication, how resources flow, how life functions to give rise to things that we as humans find useful and we make use of to give ourselves quality of life, doesn't seem to me to be anything particularly contentious. It's a sort of fundamental piece of logic. And that's what our interest is. How do we connect companies and people with the fundamentals of life such that they will be making choices more likely to allow us all to have good quality of life for ourselves and our children over time?
Yes, I agree. The planet is simply borrowed from the future generations. Joss, if people love this, if they want to reach out, if they want to learn more, if they want to get in touch, what are some of the best ways for them to contact you?
So they can contact me via our website, terrafinity.com. I should get that right. They can find me on LinkedIn, Joss Tantrum. They can look me up on Amazon. They can look at, we have a book series called Towards 9 Billion, the first of which is called Capitalism, What's the Point? Which I think speaks to a number of our issues. And to which I answer, I think there is a point, but we need to actually be a little bit more conscious about what the intentions of the system are. So they can look at my books on Amazon, LinkedIn, or contact us through terrafinity.com.
So go check out terrafinity.com, TERRAFINITI.com, or you can look them up on LinkedIn and on Amazon, Joss, JOSS, Tantrum, TANTRAM. Joss, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an honor and a pleasure to share this mind space with you and to discuss these ideas. I really value your work and I value your insights. And thank you for coming and sharing with my audience and I so we can all be better prepared for the future.
Thank you so much, Daryl. I hugely appreciate it. It's a great honor for me as well. 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 For me as well.